welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 2nd of August, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, it's the beginning of another week, and that means we are joined today by Max Mussum from Western Spring to discuss the news and to talk about this week's Greatest Britain. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? How's your weekend been?
My weekend has been really good, actually, yes. I think that we've got the best weather, I suppose, that we've had over the course of the year. The weather's been a little bit unsettled to some extent because we have had periods of rain and also some high winds. But in between those, we've had some very nice dry times. And particularly as I do a fair bit of motorcycling for my leisure, it's quite good to have weather that's not too hot, but on the other hand, not wet or cold. And so the weather that we've been having just recently has been pretty good for that.
Has been a really hot summer. It's been like those old summers that I remember from when I was a child, when you'd have the summer holidays and it just seemed like it was sunny every day. You know, you've had a heat wave. I've had to have the fans on. It's nice to actually have a proper summer, and it's nice to get a little bit of rain and see the greenery getting really bright and shiny once it's been raining. And of course, we've had the unlocking as well in England, that is, and you don't have to wear masks anymore there. Unfortunately, we're still having to wear masks over here in Wales, and there's a big drive on at the moment to try and get young people to take vaccines, and they're pushing this idea that there's going to be vaccine passports that are going to be needed for nightclubs and for travel. And they've had programs on the television with Jonathan Van Tam answering questions from young people who all seem to be very, very sceptical about these vaccines. And I'm not surprised they're sceptical about the vaccines when they really don't have any chance of getting ill so much from COVID. Or if they do, it's a very, very tiny chance. There's far more of a chance that they're going to end up getting blood clots, or they're going to end up having serious problems. And this Jonathan Van Tam was trying to say, well, it is a risk and it has gone up, and he was trying to sort of massage the figures a little bit. And I was quite impressed with the young people. They seemed to be pretty sensible, pretty shrewd. They weren't being taken in really by what he was saying, and they were asking good questions. So I was quite impressed with that. But, and we're also hearing about how these vaccines themselves, it's the people that are vaccinated that are actually catching COVID. They're not telling the public that in America. Biden is still saying it's the unvaxxed that are spreading the virus. But at least over here in Britain, we are being told it's something like 40%, I believe, of the hospital admissions are actually people that have been vaccinated. So what is the point of all of this, and why are they bringing these passports in? It all seems very suspicious to me. And you were saying, Max, that you had some confirmation of something that you were suggesting earlier in the year, that these vaccines were likely to produce new vaccine resistant variants. Is that something that you've come across this week?
Well, there was an article that I read recently on that particular subject, and it was something that I predicted not just earlier this year, but actually earlier last year, in the spring of last year, when the virus first came out and there was talk about the development of vaccines. And one of the things that I predicted was that just as we have had the development of superbugs as a result of the use of antibiotics, in situations where the antibiotics don't completely eradicate the bug, what happens is that the variant, the genetic variant of that bug that survives, is the one which is the most infectious and the most virulent, and so that's then created the superbugs that hospitals are now struggling to cope with, and that there are quite frequently doomsayers in the news telling us about how the world is going to be badly affected by antibiotic resistant superbugs in the future. Well, I've seen my first article so far since I wrote that is confirming that certain medical authorities are predicting that there will, as a result of the use of vaccines, there will, it's quite likely that there will develop much more virulent and infectious strains of coronavirus in the future, and that we need to prepare ourselves for this eventuality. And so it's nice that the medical profession is slowly coming round to a point of view that I expressed almost 2 years ago. And you know, it is something that we do need to think about. And where you have a vaccine, if you can spread the vaccine, and this is, you know, something in which I share the opinion with the World Health Authority, really, which is that if we're going to use the vaccines to combat coronavirus, we need to get the vaccines all around the world so that the virus everywhere in the world is eliminated. And that's the only way of effectively eliminating the coronavirus, because if we allow any of it to survive, even in the most remote corners of the world, what will happen is that it will be the most resistant, the most vaccine-resistant variant of the disease that will survive, and it will then over the years proliferate and spread again, and then we'll have another wave of a super virus that is resistant to the current vaccines, and it may be that we won't be quite so lucky next time in devising a vaccine that's able to combat the virus as quickly as we were with this initial virus. And so that's something that the authorities need to take very carefully indeed. And it would be such a great shame if we've gone through all of these lockdowns for the last 18 months, 2 years, only to then find that we're back at square one and that all of the lockdowns have had no effect because the way in which we've distributed the vaccines has then meant that we've got these super strains that potentially could evolve and which could be just as nasty, if not more nasty, than the original virus was.
We need to prepare ourselves for booster shots. I think that's what they're sort of suggesting, is that people are going to need a top up. They're going to need an update every 6 months or so. They're already talking about that for the elderly, saying that they're going to need an update. But the thing is, if you actually have a natural resistance to it, if you actually catch COVID and you fight it off, which 99% of people do, then they have a good immunity against it anyway. They don't need to be vaccinated, and that immunity will last, apparently, from looking at other coronaviruses. If you fight them off, that immunity is going to last for years, and it will fight off all coronaviruses, not just the small amount of them that the vaccine will fight off, because all the vaccine does is tell your body to produce its own spike protein, and the actual virus itself is a lot more than just a spike protein. So if you're immune to the spike protein, you're still not immune to the rest of the virus. If you've actually had the virus and you fought it off, you're going to be immune to catching it again. If you do catch it again, it's really not going to affect you. I find it most bizarre that Boris Johnson isolates himself when he gets pinged. I mean, he caught the virus, he fought it, so he had an immunity. And then he went and got vaccinated, which he didn't need to do because he already had an immunity. And now, even though he's been vaccinated and he's already got a natural immunity, he isolates when this app pings him. I think most people are switching these apps off. We've had all sorts of problems apparently with supermarket shelves that are empty, and people can't get lorry drivers. Another real problem that people are coming across is getting people to come back to work, because everybody's used to being furloughed. They're used to not working, and a lot of people have just disappeared, and the bosses can't actually find the people that were working for them before. I think a lot of people have got used to being on their benefits as well, and they're not really interested in coming back to work for only a few more pounds than they're actually getting on their benefits. Because, you know, if you're a single man and you're working, if you're not working, you're going to get your housing benefit, your council tax, your job seekers allowance or whatever. And if you do work, you're probably only going to earn another £50 on top. So I think a lot of people have got used to not working, and these are all the sort of problems that we're going to have to overcome if we want to get the economy back how we had it before. Do you think the economy is ever going to go back to where it was, or do you think there's going to be more problems, Max?
I think it's unlikely to go back to where it was. It might go back to something closer to what it was than it is now eventually, but all the things that you've been talking about, a lot of people have found that by working from home, first of all, whereas they may have had to wear a suit and tie in the office, and therefore there would be wear and tear on the suits and ties, and periodically they'd have to replace their suits and ties and the shoes, etc. When they're sitting at home, they're perhaps sitting at home in a pair of jogging bottoms with a t-shirt, and they're doing everything online, and nobody can see that they look scruffy. But by being scruffy when they're doing their work at home, it means they're saving money because they're not buying expensive suits and ties and things. And so some people are going to be resistant to going back to work as a result of that. Other people have also found that because of the pandemic, when they've tried to use public transport, the public transport hasn't been running fully because so many of the train drivers and the bus drivers, etc., have been self-isolating at home. And so it's been difficult and unreliable getting into work as a result of that. And if we add to that the fact that Khan, who's the mayor of London, has increased the charges for going, the congestion charge and the emissions charges for going into the centre of London. And according to newspaper statements a few days ago, that there is every intention on the part of the mayor of London to retain those additional charges, which will then mean that it's going to be very costly for certain people to go into the centres of large cities, particularly the centre of London, in order to conduct their daily work. And that's going to drive prices up. All the people that work in offices in the centre of London who will perhaps pop out to a sandwich bar or perhaps one of these mobile sandwich bars will find that the owners of the mobile sandwich bars can't get into London very easily because of these additional charges. And what you'll also find is that the workers who would normally work in the sandwich bars will either have to live sufficiently close to some means of public transport that is less affected by the pandemic, or if they live somewhere where the pandemic is having devastating effect, then they'll find that they'll have great difficulty getting into work. And so there are all sorts of problems of this sort, which mean that people will increasingly find that it's easier to work from home if the technology exists to allow them to do it. And I think it would be very difficult for an employer to persuade an employee that they have to go back to work just because there wouldn't really be any plus argument that could be used where the plus was on the side of the employee. The plus would only ever be on the side of the employer if they deemed that there was. But there again, you see, lots of employers would also be saving money because they can allow the leases on their expensive city centre offices to lapse. And they can use the money that they save, that they're not paying out for rents in future, to make up for any losses they've suffered as a result of COVID. And they can also use that to, if necessary, if they need to attract more people to come and work for them, then they can pay higher salaries and offer higher salaries. And so I think that, having sort of gone through all that, I've pretty well talked myself into the point of view that we probably won't go back to how it was before. As I say, we might get a bit closer to it than where we are now, but I think it's highly unlikely that things will return to how they were before.
There's a lot of knock-on effects, isn't there? I mean, you're pointing out there, if people aren't going into the offices, then the shops around them and the cafes and the sandwich bars and places where you can go for a snack, they're not going to have the clientele that they used to have before. I mean, it could really change the face of our cities. You know, there's a lot of things that may well change, as well as the fact that they've got this great reset and they want to build back better, as Boris Johnson calls it. They've got all these ideas, plus you've got all these other things that are knock-on effects. I mean, we could be looking at a very different Britain in a year's time. Of course, we've had things to take our minds off of that as well. We've got the Olympics that's on at the moment, and I really haven't watched much of that. I just switch over and watch the news in the mornings now instead of watching the breakfast TV. I'm not aware of how many medals we've actually won. We did talk about this a little bit on the Daily Nationalist last Wednesday, but I know you've had taken a little bit of an interest in how Britain have been doing. How have Britain been doing at the Olympics, Max?
We're not doing badly. I think we're something like about six in the medal rankings, which is pretty good for a country of our size. Whenever I look at the medal rankings, I always think that it's a great shame that that we didn't maintain the empire, and not from the point of view that we should have maintained the empire for any kind of power trip side of things, but just from the point of view that the majority of people who live in Australia are of English extraction, or British extraction, I should say. The majority of people living in New Zealand still are of British extraction, and the same goes for Canada. And so when you look at these medal tables and you see how close we are to the top, but we're being beaten by countries like China and the USA, primarily, who've got much bigger populations than we have. And so therefore, the potential for them to have a world-class athlete in any particular sphere is greater than ours is. You know, if had we retained the empire, then we would have been topping these medal tables. And I was thinking that the biggest mistake that was made at the time of empire was that we didn't offer democracy to the countries like Australia and Canada, etc., and we didn't offer democracy to the European inhabitants of the USA either, and so you know, then we had the War of Independence, and the point is that had our forefathers had the foresight to say, well, look, we want the empire to feel just as, you know, all the far-flung parts of the empire, we want them to feel just as much a part of the empire, and just as much we want them to feel that they are the movers and shakers of the empire. So therefore, we will create constituencies where MPs will be elected, who will then come to the British Parliament in Westminster, or perhaps somewhere else if they could think of find somewhere a bit more convenient. And we could have had MPs from Canada, from New Zealand, from Australia, from South Africa, etc., all coming and meeting and all giving their opinions and all voting on the way in which the empire should develop. And that way, there wouldn't have been the drive for independence on the part of those nations. And so, therefore, the empire would have stayed together. And as I say, in things like international sport, we would be a dominant force, and we'd also be a dominant force in lots of other areas where our influence nowadays has been diminished by virtue of the reduced status of the United Kingdom.
I'd like to see an ethnic Olympics. You know, where we actually had the ethnicities competing against one another, so to see who's, you know, the best ethnicity at running, who's the best ethnicity at swimming, rather than having it by country, so you can actually see the different races and the different ethnicities and watch them compete against one another. You know, that would be good. I'd like to see that, but they don't do that, do they? They do it by country, not by ethnicity.
Well, they do it by country, but I think you can still get an idea of that by virtue of individual countries and the ethnicities of the people who compose the Olympic team. And so, for example, if you look at swimming, for example, swimming is dominated by white Europeans, and we traditionally do well in the swimming. We've got triathlon that's been sort of fairly publicised just recently because of the successes we've had and the triathlon mixed relay was last night, which the British team won on, etc. And so there are some events where the people involved are primarily of British or white European ethnic descent, and we can see how well they do in various sports. And again, today I watched a little bit of the track and field, and you could see there in the short distance sprinting, the 200, the 100 meters and 200 meters, etc., that the African American and other black countries tended to dominate in those sports, which suggests that black people have a greater ability when it comes to short distance explosive energy or power, whatever you call it, in order to do something the fastest or the furthest in that respect. And also we do find as well that Africans from East Africa, who differ significantly from the Africans from West Africa, and you know, who are in what I would describe as of a different racial type. They've both got darker skins than Europeans, but they are significantly different in terms of their morphology. And what we find is that the East African countries tend to do better at long distance running, but Europeans tend to do better in races where there's technology involved, and so things like skiing, things like cycling or swimming, anything of that sort, you find that the teams tend to be overwhelmingly white, and so we can get a sense of what an ethnic Olympics would be. But one of the things that caught my eye couple of days was that it was noticeable because of how well the British athletes have been doing in the swimming and the triathlon and some of the other sports. It was noticeable that our rowing team have done far worse this Olympics than they have done in previous Olympics. And whereas I think it was we had something like 9 golds in the last Olympics, we've only so far had 2 medals, neither of which have been gold so far in the rowing events. And something significant seems to have changed in the way in which our rowing athletes have been prepared for the Olympics. And it was revealed in an article that was on the Daily Mail website that the head coach for the British rowing team his contract came up for renewal at the end of last year, because he was contracted to manage the British rowing team up until the Tokyo Olympics. But the Tokyo Olympics should have been held last year. They've been deferred as a result of COVID-19, and what that's meant is this chap needed to have an extra year added onto his contract. But because he's 74, he didn't want there to be a long addition to his contract. He just wanted just one extra year so that he could carry the team through to victory again at the Tokyo Olympics. But the British Olympic Association didn't want that, and this was the reasoning behind this seems to be, from the news that's emerging and from various spokespeople that have been speaking to the Daily Mail, the reasoning behind this seems to be that there was a change of heart on the part of the British Olympic Association, where they felt that it was old-fashioned to have grueling training sessions in order to bring out the best in their rowers, and what they wanted was a more sort of nurturing and caring kind of environment for the rowers. And the chap who had been in charge of who had been our head coach for the rowing team was called Jürgen Kröbler. He was a man of East German origin, and who had learnt his trade basically working with the Eastern European countries, but had since I think around about 1990 had been associated with the rowing team over here in the UK. And during that period between 1990 and this year, he had produced 20 champions who have won 33 gold medals over that period of time. And so he is the most successful coach that we've ever had. And the period during which he was our coach was the period during which our rowing teams have been the most successful they've ever been. But he was allowed to resign and go, and somebody else has taken over. Well, in fact, what's happened is Steve Redgrave apparently is quoted in the Daily Mail as stating that what's happened is that whereas Jürgen Kröbler was fairly autocratic in terms of the way in which he ran the rowing team and used to choose the people himself that he wanted to represent Britain, based upon his own gut instinct and his own experience and knowledge of who the people were and how they would fare under the pressure, etc., that they're going to be under. But what's happened now is that the people of the individuals that will take part in the rowing are chosen by a committee. And this committee, as I said, is one that, which is going to have a far more woke attitude to the way in which our athletes will be trained in rowing in the future. This kind of this kind of diminution or this kind of decay in the way in which our athletes are trained and prepared for the Olympics doesn't seem to have permeated every part of our Olympic team. There still seems to be parts of our Olympic team that are doing well, but it certainly seems to have had a dramatic effect on the rowing team. And so Steve Redgrave said, if we want a soft approach, this is him being quoted in the on the Mail website, if we want a soft approach, we will have to expect softer results. And he said that he was particularly critical of the decision to change the ways in which the teams are selected, i.e. by committee rather than Gröbler. He said, with the systems that we have put back in the selection, of selection panels and so forth, we've moved back to the 1970s and 1980s, and we have to accept 1970s and 1980s results. So basically what he's saying is that the success that the British rowing team have had since the 1990s has been down to Gröbler's method of coaching, and that it, without that, he can see that the level of success we will have in rowing in future Olympics will diminish to the same sort of levels that we experienced before Gröbler became the coach for the British rowing team, which is a great shame.
So they want a caring, sharing coach rather than a coach that is actually hard on the sportsmen and actually gets the best out of them. It's just a race to the bottom, isn't it? You know, you've always got to push yourself. And these coaches, I mean, sometimes I've read things where they've accused them of being too harsh on the sportsmen or the sportswomen. But they need somebody cracking the whip to really get the best out of them. I mean, how is this rowing team going to feel now that they haven't actually won? If they kept on with the coach they had before, they would have won the medals. As it is, now they haven't. Now they're not coming home with the medals. It's a shame, really. I mean, because you try to push yourself and you think that you're capable of always pushing yourself, but sometimes you just need somebody else to get that little extra bit more out of you. So that is a shame anyway. But shall we get into our greatest Britons then, Max, for today?
What I'd just like to say is that in a more serious sphere, which is that of the defence of the nation, we've had traditionally soldiers being trained with fairly harsh training methods, where soldiers have been driven to the point where they've been so exhausted and they've they're stomachs have retched so much that they've vomited and things of this sort in order to try and achieve the levels of excellence and training that they have to achieve. And particularly in this respect, the SAS are there. And what's happening now is we can see this kind of woke approach to sort of caring and nurturing of people extending even into the military now, to the point where there is a great likelihood that the fighting effectiveness of our armed forces, and in particular our elite armed forces, the SAS, because if you think about it, the SAS are an elite corps within the armed forces, and our Olympic athletes are a unique category of people within our nation, and if we prevent people who are striving for the excellence that they do, if we want them to continue to do that, then they have to drive themselves with that superhuman determination. And when we find a recipe for allowing these people to develop to their fullest extent and to be most successful, if you find a recipe that works, we should stick with that recipe that works. And there was just one last thing, actually, was that there was a scene where I can't remember what nationality this gymnast was, but this gymnast was about to go on and perform. And as they arrived at, now I don't think it was a, well, I'm not sure if it was a gymnast, it might have been, it was an athlete of some sort, but it was indoors. And as this athlete reached the point where they were about to go up onto the podium in order to compete, their coach was stood there, and their coach slapped them around the face twice and gave them a good shake, and then sent them on to I think actually it might have been a martial arts one either, but slapped them around the face, gave them a good shake, and then sent them on. And the point is that there was a wave of complaints by people saying, oh, how terrible it was that this poor person was being abused by their coach. But then the athlete concerned came back and defended the coach, said, no, 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 I want the coach to do this because, you know, by slapping me around the face and giving me a good shake, it puts me, it gets my adrenaline going, it puts me in the frame of mind where I can do my best in the actual competition. And so, you know, this is an example really of where all this wokeness is taking us in the wrong direction, basically.
I did see the footage of that coach that was really going wild, trying to encourage whoever it was, his sportsman. And the woman next to him was thinking, "God, he looks a little bit strange." But I thought that was quite moving. See somebody so emotional and caught up in the moment and cheering on their, you know, their ward or whoever it was. I thought that was good. And he was criticised for that. But yeah, you know, do what you do with gusto. Well, shall we get into our greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, I think we might actually finish with Robert Blatchford today. We've finished off with the quotes from Merry England, and we'll get back to talking about Robert Blatchford's life. And we got up to just about during the war. And in his articles during the war, Blatchford campaigned for better pay for the soldiers and considerable pensions for disabled soldiers, soldiers' widows and children. When a soldier wrote to him claiming his opinions would not be accepted by the army, but those of Philip Snowden and Ramsay MacDonald would, Blatchford replied, "I'm sorry, I cannot help it. You want peace, but you cannot have peace without victory. The struggle with Germany will not end with the present war, and we may someday have to fight Germany single-handed." And remember, that was the First World War that he was talking about there. So he was actually sort of presaging the Second World War. So he knew more about this than Rudyard Kipling did, I think. He seems to understand things a little bit better. Would that be right, Max?
Well, my feelings are that Robert Blatchford seemed to change his opinion on a number of things as he got older. And he's most famous, as we've already discussed, for the efforts that he put into the founding of the Labour Party and the Clarion Group, etc. During those early periods, he espoused a form of socialism which I would describe as being a nationalist form of socialism, or national socialism, depending on how you want to describe it. That situation in terms of his opinion on politics seemed to persist until we started to get into the 30s and the 40s, where his political opinions started to change. And what we don't bear in mind quite often is that he was born in 1851, which meant he was already 49 at the turn of the 20th century. And so when you look at the Second World War, he was already 88 when the Second World War started. He would have been roughly 20 years younger, obviously, when the First World War started. And I think that with age, Robert Blatchford's analytical abilities started to diminish. And so he says things which I don't think are consistent with his earlier beliefs. And he holds opinions which aren't necessarily national socialistic, and which tend to be more jingoistic. He seems to be more influenced by the jingoistic nature of the press than his own sort of analysis of politics.
I think it's interesting. He says you cannot have peace without victory, and he was assured of the fact that, you know, Britain must be the guys in charge. If it's not the British in charge, then, you know, who do you think else is going to be good enough to run things? So he certainly believed in himself. Unfortunately, Blatchford's wife died in 1921, and in 1923 he would write in response to claims in the press that he had been converted away from socialism by reading Henry Ford's autobiography that, quote, "I have never been converted from socialism, but careful observation of the facts for the last 12 years or so has convinced me that socialism will not work. And a study of Mr. Ford's methods has provided what seems to me as good a substitute as we may hope in this imperfect world. Socialism as I knew it in past years was an excellent, almost a perfect theory. The golden rule will not work in international politics because the nations are not good enough to live up to it. Real socialism strongly resembles real Christianity. It is a council of perfection and cannot be adopted and adhered to by our imperfect humanity. There is nothing the matter with socialism, but the people are neither wise enough nor good enough to make it a success. Socialism implies the self-abnegation of the individual for the good of the community. And that's nationalism, isn't it, really? The self-abnegation of the individual for the good of the nation. So you can see there the link that there is between nationalism and socialism. And I'm also intrigued by the fact that he was impressed with Henry Ford. And I wonder whether he read any of Henry Ford's other works in the Dearborn Independent. Do you know anything about that, Max, about his views on Henry Ford?
Yeah, he read some of the ideas of Henry Ford, and Henry Ford was somebody who's renowned as having been a capitalist, but he was also a socialist in many ways. And I think that the distinction we have to draw here between socialism and Marxism, or socialism and communism, is that communism and Marxism are forms of socialism. I mean, socialism just means an organized society. And so having an organized society can't be regarded as being a good or a bad thing, unless you're an anarchist, I suppose, and you don't believe in any kind of organization for society. But for most people, having some kind of an organized society is a good thing. And Blatchford's earlier socialism was socialism insofar as he saw it orientated around the needs of the nation. And I think that if you have socialism orientated around the needs of the nation, then socialism can work. I think that where Blatchford's tends to move away from socialism and towards Ford's ideas are where he starts to confuse or starts to view socialism only as either communism or Marxism, or some kind of happy clappy kumbaya kind of humanist socialism of the sort that is, you know, often espoused by people on the left who have no real sort of conception of what governing a nation is all about. But as far as Henry Ford is concerned, Henry Ford introduced what was regarded as welfare capitalism into the United States. I don't know whether he was the first person to do that, but that's certainly something that he did. And what Henry Ford did was comparable to what a number of Quaker families did over here in the UK, which such as Cadbury's, for example. Cadbury's created the Bourneville Village, which was near their chocolate producing plant in just outside Birmingham. And, you know, the Bourneville chocolate bar is named after Bourneville Village. And what you found in Bourneville was that the Cadbury family had decided that if they wanted their workers to work happily and to give their best in terms of producing as high a quality of product as possible and as great a volume of the product as possible, then they needed to look after their workers, and they needed to have a paternalist approach to looking after their workers. And so they created what was like an idyllic village or small town of Bourneville, where the properties were inhabited solely by their workers. And so there was no worries about whether their workers could afford to live near the factory, because Cadbury's actually made them houses so they could. So it was a definite that yes, they could. And there were all sorts of other things that helped to support a healthy society. There was all of the infrastructure that's needed to support a healthy society were pre-planned and built into the Bourneville village. And so that would have been a form of socialism, but I don't think that the Cadbury family would have regarded themselves as socialist. They would have regarded themselves as sensible business people exercising what would be regarded as an enlightened form of capitalism, where you provide for your workers and you create an organized society that enables your workers to work as best they can for you. And other Quaker families did similar things. There was a Quaker. In fact, it wasn't a Quaker family, but there was a movement within the Labour Party that was reflected by this, the fact that there were these Quaker families. I know that Letchworth Garden City and the other garden cities that were created during the interwar period and the early post-war period, those garden cities followed a similar kind of theme where they tried to create houses, and the post-war Labour government tried to create houses that were that provided the sufficient amenity and sufficient infrastructure to support the people that worked in them, so that they could therefore be expected to perform at their best when they were actually at work. And that is an enlightened form of capitalism, or you could call it an enlightened form of socialism. And that was the kind of thing that Henry Ford advocated. I mean, Henry Ford, when he started up his factories in 1914, doubled the rate of pay. So his workers were paid double, in fact, slightly more than double the average rate of pay for somebody in the motor industry. And so therefore, everybody that worked within easy reach of the Ford factories wanted to work for Ford because they would earn twice as much money. And so there was Henry Ford never had any problems recruiting people because they flocked to him because of the rates of pay that he provided. And he introduced profit sharing schemes that enabled the workers that worked hard to profit from the profits that were generated in the factories in which they worked. And all of this, it can be regarded as being an enlightened form of capitalism, if you want, or an enlightened form of socialism. But it was an attempt on the part of various people to create organized societies that were benevolent societies, that weren't doctrinaire Marxist or communist societies, but they were, as I say, benevolent societies that looked after their workers.
I should imagine that by this time, socialism had become tied up with Marxism, and that's what people were thinking of when they were thinking of socialism. They were thinking of Marxism and Bolshevism, so I should imagine he wanted to distance himself from that as well.
And where he says that he felt that humanity is not perfect enough to practice socialism, really what he's thinking of there, he's making the mistake of thinking of socialism as being international socialism. And because of his advanced age at this point, the fact that he's sort of perhaps getting into his 80s or whatever, and his, in my view, faculties perhaps aren't as sharp as they would have been before, he's making the mistake of thinking that a national-oriented form of socialism, a nationalist, a form of national socialism, could be spread around the world, which of course it can't do, because the world is divided into different nations, each of which have their own hopes and dreams, and all of which want to develop in their own particular way with their own cultures, etc. So you can't have a form of socialism that works for everybody in the world, and this is where, to some extent, I think Blatchford was influenced by the happy clappy kumbaya humanist form of socialism.
Well, when the first Labour government led by Ramsay MacDonald took office in 1924, Blatchford responded to Thompson's enthusiasm with, "I don't like their policy and I don't trust them. They are in no sense socialists. At present they are liberals, and we shall have a blend of liberal shibboleths and communist insanity." When Sir Edward Holton sold most of his newspapers to Lord Rothermere, Blatchford wrote in a letter to the Morning Post, "As a protest against the attempt of the syndicated newspapers to muzzle the press and dictate to the government, I have resigned my position on the Sunday Chronicle and the Sunday Herald. The public should be helped to realise that the political judgments of the syndicated newspapers are not sincere and considered opinions of trained, independent thinkers, but the broadcast railings of one rich man in a panic over the capital levy. It is important that this should be said, and that the country should understand that the voice of Lord Rothermere is not the voice of public opinion. His standardised newspapers are journalistic tied houses, where proprietorial dope is sold as honest beer." I mean, that's two very good opinions there. I mean, he's very suspicious of the Labour Party, is not supportive of the Labour Party, and he says that it's just going to be liberal shibboleths and communist insanity. And he understands here the dangers of the media being taken over by the oligarchs, and you've got a whole set of newspapers here, which is just going to become the mouthpiece of this Lord Rothermere.
Yeah, yeah, I think, and that that is a perceptive point of view being expressed there by Blatchford. So,
quite an early stage as well. Quite an early stage, really. I mean, was that 1920s to be suspicious of the newspapers at that time? I mean, we traced it as really sort of happening, what was it, about 1870, when they started really influencing the government and calling for General Gordon to go out there to the Sudan. I think that was about 1870, so about 50 years ago. And he's spotting it now in 1920, this influence that the media has started to have. And of course, it's so strong now that they literally manipulate the government. It's hard to tell where the media ends and the government begins nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Blatchford eventually voted conservative in 1924. However, his later books indicate a continued faith in his own English version of socialism. Moreover, the Clarion movement carried on as a socialist popular movement, taking its cue from Blatchford right into the 1930s and beyond, as indicated by the continued existence of the Clarion Rambling and Cycling Clubs and the founding of the newspaper The New Clarion in 1932. In a 1931 letter to Alexander Thompson, Blatchford proclaimed his last political credo, his language remaining fiery and eloquent, and he said, "I have always been a Tory Democrat. You remember that from the first the Clarion crowd and the Hardy crowd were out of harmony. I loathe the top-hatted, frock-coated, magnolia-scented snobocracy as much as you do. But I cannot away with the Keir Hardys and Arthur Hendersons and Ramsay MacDonalds and Bernard Shaws and Maxtons. Not long ago you told me in a letter of some trade union delegates who were smoking cigars and drinking whisky at the House of Commons at the expense of their unions. You liked them not. Nor do I like the trade union bigots who have cheated J.H. Thomas of his pension. I am glad the Labour Party is defeated, because I believe they would have disrupted the British Empire. I dreaded their childish cosmopolitanism, their foolish faith that we could abolish crime by reducing the police force. All the other nations are out for their own ends. American enthusiasm for naval disarmament is not dictated by love of peace. It is an expression of naval rivalry. All the nations hated our naval supremacy. Do the Americans love us? Do the French love us? Is France, America, Italy devoted to an unselfish and human peace? Can we dispel the bellicose sentiments of Russia and China and Japan by sending an old pantaloon to talk platitudes at Geneva, or by disbanding the Horse Guards and scrapping a few submarines? The England of my affection and devotion is not a country nor a people. It is a tradition, the finest tradition the world has ever produced. The Labour Party do not subscribe to that tradition, do not know it, could not feel it. And if that tradition is to survive, the policy of scuttle and surrender must be abandoned. You agree with all this, I feel sure. You always upheld the Pax Britannica. We have not drifted apart, old pal. Our separation is only geographical." And I find this interesting because he's pointing out that this drive from these other countries to get us to do things is not to our benefit. It's going to be to their benefit. And he says, how ridiculous to think that this American enthusiasm for naval disarmament is a love of peace. It's naval rivalry. It's because they want our navy to be weaker than their navy. And of course, this is what goes on with ethnicities. This is what goes on with races. And we're told now that, oh, no, everybody is the same. And these other ethnicities, when they come up with these ideas and they promote these ideas, it's all for our own good. And it's not. It's to their own good. And it's anything that weakens us as a nation is to a benefit of other nations. And if you're living in a multicultural nation, anything that weakens your ethnicity is to the benefit of the other ethnicities. And this is the constant competition that we see going on. And we see here where he identifies this, he understands that. And that means to me that everybody understood that back then. And it's just today that we don't understand this. I mean, it cannot just have been him that was pointing this out. And of course, we see that the Labour Party are the ones that are going along with this. They're the ones that are believing these ideas. And we would suggest that they just pretended to believe these ideas, and actually they were really working to try and set up a new world order. They wanted to bring international communism in. I mean, that's why they would support the idea of weakening the Navy, is because they wanted to bring in internationalism. What do you make of what he has to say here, and the fact that he calls himself, what is it, a Tory Democrat? What do you think he means by that, Max?
I think he's going, this is one of the examples of where he's got himself a bit muddled in terms of what he's saying, because what he's failing to see, I mean, you're quite right in your observations you just made, that that individual nations will have their own self-interest, and individual ethnic groups will have their own self-interest within a multi-ethnic or multiracial society. But what Blatchford failed to fully appreciate, in my view, was the importance of race as a central tenet of the socialism that he espoused. And what's tended to happen is that as he's seen the Labour Party become corrupted by the communists and the Marxists and the crooked trade unionists, what he's seen, what he's done is he's turned away from socialism and decried socialism, thinking of it as an ideology that's too pure for the people to understand, when in reality he was trying to sort of advocate it at that point in time was as an ideology that didn't really serve the people's needs. But at the same time, instead of turning towards a proper national socialism, he is turning towards a sort of king and country kind of Tory version of patriotism, which uses all the same sort of patriotic platitudes and exhortations, etc., but is a form of politics where people don't actually mean what they say, and they're only just using words in order to deceive the public, and that was the perception that he failed to make there, in my view. But there again, Blatchford, at the age of 43, was 49 plus 43, that's 92 years of age. So that's what I'm saying. I think Blatchford is a fantastic person from the point of view of the clarity of his thought, particularly in his in the early part of the 20th century. But then as the Second World War approached, and as he went through the Second World War, his clarity of thought wasn't quite as good as it might have been originally. And so he did say some things which don't entirely make sense nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, how could people continue a tradition if they were a different people? I guess he hadn't thought of that. I mean, when he was saying that his loyalty is to the tradition, the English traditions, rather than the English people. But if you don't have the English people or the British nations, you're not going to have those traditions. That they're just not going to continue. It's going to be the traditions of the different people that are living here. I mean, people groups have always emigrated all around the world, and they take their traditions with them. They don't take on the traditions of the people that they move into. I guess unless they're superior traditions, but then it's not really traditions. It's just a civilization. I'm thinking then of the Roman Empire, when peoples came into the Roman Empire. But of course, then that fell apart when you didn't have enough Romans in it. So I guess we can excuse him because he's getting on a little bit. And on 17th of December 1943, Blatchford died in Horsham, Sussex, at the ripe old age of 92. I mean, that is a good age to get to. Obviously, his views on healthy living and fresh air, they certainly did him some good, didn't they, to have him live to 92. Well, Blatchford's love of country themes were not a late aberration, but can be found throughout his output. His combination of libertarianism, socialism and conservatism mark him out as one of the more original activists in English political history. The first Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Snowden, said of Blatchford in his autobiography, "In these years, Mr. Blatchford gave invaluable help to socialist propaganda. No man did more than he to make socialism understood by the ordinary working man. His writings in them had nothing of economic abstruseness. He based his appeal on the principles of human justice. He preached socialism as a system of industrial cooperation for the common good. His arguments and illustrations were drawn from facts and experiences within the knowledge of the common people. Socialism, as he taught it, was not a cold, materialistic theory, but the promise of a new life, as full of sweet and noble as the world can give. Mr. Blatchford is still living, hale and hearty, his mental powers undiminished at the ripe age of 83. I saw him recently, and we talked of those grand and inspiring times of 40 years ago. Only the men who were in the socialist movement in those days can know the great part that Robert Blatchford took in making it popular, and of the personal devotion he inspired by his writings. So that was the first Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Snowden, there, and of course he was very critical of the Labour Party. So perhaps he was friends with this Philip Snowden that actually went on to join them. And you were saying, Max, that the Labour Party and the socialists today, that they try to forget Robert Blatchford and they don't talk about him that much, which is a great shame, really, that they try to ignore these people that actually came up with the idea of socialism in the first place, because it doesn't fit them today. It doesn't fit with their internationalist idea of it. I mean, he's pointing out here that it came from the knowledge of the common people, and from talking to them and the experiences that he had as a common person.
Well, one of the most frustrating things that you can experience if you are a nationalist activist is doorstep canvassing during an election and finding somebody comes to the door who agrees with every single one of the policies advocated by the nationalist candidate standing in that area. But when you then ask them, well, can we count on your vote? They say, well, no, I think I'm going to carry on voting Labour because my father voted Labour and his father before him. And this is where, this is why the Labour Party don't want there to be any great analysis of Blatchford or his early writings. And that's just simply because it makes it obvious that the Labour Party today is nothing like the Labour Party was that Robert Blatchford helped to create. And it would then make stark in the minds of the people who still habitually support the Labour Party that, you know, what they're doing is ridiculous, and that it's not the name of the party that counts. It's the policies advocated by the party that counts. In fact, it's the policies implemented by the party that counts, because, you know, all too often we have conservative politicians who know exactly what the public want, but who say what they think we want them we want to hear, but then once they're in power, do the opposite, and the Labour Party do the same thing as well. And it's just so sad, really, that things have reached the kind of low ebb that they have. But, you know, there is hope for the future, and I think that particularly with the spread of our ideas on the internet and through programs like this, where we talk about, you know, the way that people felt and the things that people used to say and believe in the past, that our ideas will spread, and people will realize that the ideas of nationalism are the ideas that their forefathers struggled to establish, and the values and the principles that their forefathers struggled to establish and to promote, and there may be a tipping point at some point in the future. Hopefully there will be, and we will see a just government in this country.
I think it's also interesting that we see that he changed from being a socialist to being a Tory, and around about this time you also had Oswald Mosley, who managed to work his way through, I think, the Liberals and the Labour Party and the Conservatives. And you can see that people were looking for something better than what there was already there, and they were trying to move into these parties and then trying to shape them in the way that they wanted, and they weren't able to. So Oswald Mosley started up his own party and his own group, and unfortunately with the Italian title of fascism, I think maybe he might have had more success if he'd come up with a British title for the party, even though it was still based on timeless principles, basically the fascist principles of everybody working together, which ties in with these socialist principles as well. Well, the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress from 1925 to 1946, Sir Walter Citrine, was influenced by Blatchford's writings. He said of Britain for the British, I found it a cogent and reasoned argument for socialism. It was written with a clearness and a bite which were unusual. Clement Attlee also spoke of Blatchford's influence on his beliefs, and A.J.P. Taylor said that Blatchford was the greatest popular journalist since Cobbett. So, I mean, he must have been a really good journalist. And even though he was critical of the trade unions, you've got the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress talking highly of him. I would suggest a large part of the reason for why he was spoken of so highly is that he was a nationalist just as much as he was a socialist. In actual fact, his socialism flowed entirely from his nationalism and his love for the English people. What are your final thoughts on Blatchford here, Max?
I would say that he's so well spoken of by various people within the Labour Party, to some extent because they actually admired his point of view, but also to some extent because they realised that when the public were exposed to Blatchford's writings, particularly the early writings during the early part of the 20th century, that they found them irresistibly logical, and so therefore a way of riding on the coattails of somebody that has got a great deal of popular appeal is to say nice things about them, even though you may not necessarily entirely agree with them in private. And I would suspect that some people that were prominent in the Labour Party, that particularly the ones that allowed Marxism and communism to permeate the Labour Party and allowed liberalism to permeate the Labour Party, those people probably didn't really agree with Robert Blatchford, and perhaps just mouthed platitudes in the hope that nobody would notice that they were opposed to what he advocated.
So they're really trying to latch on to his legacy, really, and make the most of that. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.